Werman Alney back with To the Point. The Taliban in Afghanistan have become so strong that UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has told the UN Security Council what he calls a deteriorating situation could become irreversible. Lieutenant General Sir Nick Parker is the most senior British officer in Afghanistan. He is deputy to General Stanley McChrystal, the commander of the International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF. General, it's a privilege to have you on our program. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
How bad is the military situation?
I think the conversations over the last 6 months have painted a picture which describes the fact that we have rather lost the initiative at the strategic level. And what we need to do now is to regain our momentum and demonstrate that we have undermined the insurgency.
I take it you haven't undermined the insurgency then as yet.
Well, I think it would be fair for anybody to judge that we've been here since 2001, and so we've been here for quite a long time, and we need to progress, and it is not progressing as fast as everybody would hope. Now we're in a position with a new commander who has made a new plan that is much more directive. His predecessors tended to coordinate, whereas he is now in a position where he can direct. He has changed the culture to a population-centric counterinsurgency approach, and with the announcement by the president on the 1st of December, he has 30,000 more U.S. troops and over 7,000 NATO troops. So he is an empowered commander who can undermine the insurgency.
What does population-centric mean?
Normally, people focus on the enemy. They focus on the insurgent. And success is killing or capturing the insurgent. Here, we are absolutely focused on protecting the population from the insurgent. Civilian casualties caused by mistake are as bad as anything that we could do because, of course, it alienates us from the people that we're there to help. So General McChrystal has introduced a strategy where our first concern is to look after the people that we've come here to protect.
At the meeting of 70 nations in London last week, there was a great deal of talk about reintegration and reconciliation. What do those terms mean, and to what extent were you and General McChrystal given the marching orders by that conference?
That's sort of three questions.
But it is.
Reconciliation and reintegration are different in that reintegration is something which one would expect to happen in any of these conflicts, where those people who are fighting make a choice whether they stay with the insurgency or whether they come back and join the people and the legitimate government. And if they look and see the inevitability of the government of Afghanistan's success with ISAF support, a number of people will elect to reintegrate back into the society that they have been alienated from. Reconciliation is more complicated. Reconciliation is very much a political activity because it is going for those people who are currently irreconcilable, and therefore there will have to be some sort of a political solution, which is effectively above what General McChrystal and I do. It needs to come from the government of Afghanistan and produce some sort of political settlement.
So you're talking about the Taliban. Excuse me, go ahead.
Well, you then asked about London.
I did.
The London meeting was an important milestone because I think we have got effectively our marching orders. The international community has considered what is being proposed. It's supporting the plan. And I have to say that the message that we got was one of cautious optimism. I think it was described by General McChrystal when he came back here as we've moved from an attitude in the international community of the glass half empty to now people believing that the glass is half full. And it is our job now to show that we really can make a difference.
Make a difference? What kind of difference and how soon?
We've got to make a difference for the people of Afghanistan. We've got to bring back a sense of human security to those people who are living primarily in those areas where the insurgency is at its worst. We've got to be really careful that we don't overstate how quickly this will happen. And I wouldn't wish to put a timeline to it, because that then just is something which is used to beat us with. But we will undermine the insurgency in the south over the course of the next 3 to 4 months and put in place the security conditions which will allow other actors to improve local governance, improve stability, introduce services like healthcare and education. They'll be crude to start with, but they will become increasingly mature over time. But some of these things take a long time. You don't build a police force overnight. And what we're doing concurrently with our military activity is to rebuild parts of the Afghan National Security Forces so that they are sustainable by themselves.
How concerned are you about the 18-month deadline set by the president for the beginning of withdrawal of American forces? How much pressure does that put on you?
I would characterize it actually as being largely a good thing. I mean, it sends a very clear message, first, that we need to get on with it, that the Afghans want their country to be better. They don't want this to drag on, and so it sends a very clear signal that we need to get on with it. The other thing is that it sends a message that we're not an army of occupation. We're not some sort of external force that intends to stay. So as far as the Afghans are concerned, it shows them that we want to hand over to them as soon as it is practical to do so. Of course, there are some downsides. I don't think we should overstate them too much. But clearly, if you're an insurgent, you could draw the conclusion that somebody has announced that we're going to leave in July 2011. That, of course, is not the case. As you said, it is a point where we begin to look at restructuring the ISAF force. And it'll happen at exactly the same time that the Afghan National Security Forces build their strength up to take over from us. So I think it is an entirely reasonable milestone to have in the campaign.
Again, Lieutenant General Sir Nick Parker is Deputy Commander of the International Security Assistance Force, the ISAF. He'll be with us for the rest of our program. Sarah Chase is former foreign correspondent for NPR, settled in Afghanistan, founded a business there, and is now an advisor to ISAF, the NATO command in Kabul. And Sarah Chase, good to have you back on our program.
It's great to be with you.
Let's talk about reintegration. In your opinion, are the chances of reintegration, getting fighters to choose to join the people and the legitimate government, as the general put it, rather than fighting with the Taliban, at a time when it appears that, as he said, the ISAF has lost the initiative and the Taliban are winning?
Yeah, and I don't actually think it's as much an issue of initiative as it is one of the offer. And by offer, I don't mean there's been a lot of discussion in the media about, you know, the amount of money that might be put into a program for reintegration and how that might be used to lure Taliban back. And I think that's a bit of an ill-advised way of seeing it. It's not the way ISAF is approaching the program, and it's a little bit of shortcut that we're getting in some media accounts. The concern, as far as I see it, just based on my experience before I came here to ISAF headquarters, is the degree of frustration felt on the part of most of, the ordinary Afghan population with their own government. And you called it legitimate in your question, and I think a lot of Afghans would really question that. And, you know, not only because of an electoral process that was horribly marred by basically, you know, forged votes, to be quite honest, but also based on the way Afghan officials treat the people, you know, and it's all the way from ministers down to the local cop on the street. And so the concern I have is that a reintegration effort that's not combined with a robust focus on good governance, on punishing egregiously, abusively corrupt officials, isn't going to last long. Now, that's not to say that, you know, as new forces surge in to this country, and in particular into areas that are dominated by Taliban, that there's not going to be a little bit of, ooh, let's see if we can, you know, take what's on offer, lay low for a while, and you know. And so there might be an appearance of a willingness to switch sides, but unless the political environment, and that means all the way down to the local level, to the district chief who may be, you know, setting up his district police chief, for example, who may be setting up his police officers along the roads to collect, quote, petty tolls or petty bribes on checkpoints along the roads, it's really hard for people to reintegrate into a situation like that. If you can't, if there isn't a situation of governance that people can adhere to or a political project that people can be proud of and adhere to, I don't think a reintegration effort is going to last long. And so, or any, let's say, let me back up and say any reintegration would last long. It could be, you know, a temporary, you know, sort of temporary move by people to watch what the troop uplift is going to look like and going to do.
Sarah Chase, formerly with NPR, now an advisor to ISAF, the NATO command in Kabul. This is To the Point from PRI. General Parker, let me go back to you. I used the term legitimate because it was a term that you used. What about what Sarah Chase is saying? And is it the ISAF's responsibility to punish corruption, or is somebody else responsible for that?
I think there are two aspects to this. The first is that as we conduct our operations, as Sarah has made it clear, they have to be complemented by better local governance. And the operations that we're planning at the moment are being conducted in partnership with Afghan ministries that are responsible for developing local governance. It's a huge challenge, and one mustn't underestimate it, but we are seeing a real, genuine effort to try to bring better governance to some of the more challenged parts of the country. And so with this will come better control of the police, better delivery of local services, freedom of movement that allows people to trade. But again, this is not something which we can shy away from. It is a huge challenge. Sarah mentioned the police. The leadership of the police is something which we must work with the Afghan government to improve. We have got to train them. We've got to assist them in the sorts of practices which are proper behavior. I think anything that is malicious needs to be removed, and it needs to be done because it is the right thing to do. And it needs to be the Afghans who do it. We need to partner with them, but they need to be the people who make the decisions about what is right and wrong.
Sarah Chase, what do you think of the prospects of the Afghans doing that?
Well, let me just jump in and add to what General Parker explained. This partnering role that we play, and it's you know, everything from people living inside you know, Afghan National Security Force barracks to all the way up to the ministry level. It's a very comprehensive effort that that I think offers the greatest possibility for changing behaviors. And I say that again based on my own experience before I came here, where, you know, I've been running a cooperative and it's basically embedded partnering, you know, it's embedded mentoring, the same thing that ISAF is doing. And the impact of that on rebuilding, you have to remember this is a society that's just shattered through three decades of war. And so it's a question of rebuilding habits that this country used to have, you know, 30 or 40 years ago and have been kind of deconstructed. And it does take a couple of years, 2 to 3 years of embedded partnering to start changing, you know, just rebuilding patterns of behavior. So that's very important. But the other important thing to understand is ISAF, as the largest international organization on the ground here and the one that is seen by Afghans as wielding the most power, has an enormous role to play in terms of corruption via use of leverage. We have, you know, battalion commanders that meet with provincial governors every week. We have brigade commanders that meet with deputy ministers, and that provides an opportunity to suggest different courses of action. So as General Parker says, it does have to be the Afghan government or Afghan government officials who change their behavior. But as we start asking about, you know, not just what operation can we you know, mount against the insurgency in thus and such a district, but how is it that the district chief of police, you know, just to use the same example, is extracting bribes along the road? Until now, we really haven't been asking those questions. ISAF hasn't. And in that, you know, and so this really is a focus on corruption, really does, it does constitute a part of this population-based campaign that General Parker was talking about.
Sarah Chase, formerly with NPR, now with ISAF, the Allied Command in Afghanistan. We're going to take a very, very brief break. We'll be back in a moment. Our next guest will be Ahmed Rashid, the Pakistani journalist on Reporter's Notebook. We'll update White House plans for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney again with a quick reminder of why we need to hear from you in support of this program, To the Point and Which Way LA, are the most expensive programs KCRW produces. Besides me and the technical crew, it takes 7 producers to book the more than 40 guests you hear every week, people from all over the world. We have a 25,000-name database. That means you'll be hearing from points of view that are missing even on other public radio programs. Help us pay the phone bills. Become a star subscriber for as little as $10 a month. Give what you can afford, but pledge. Call 800-600-KCRW or subscribe online at kcrw.com. That's 800-600-5279. And thanks. Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the situation in Afghanistan, where the military has lost the initiative, as we just heard from the deputy commander of ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force, and where efforts are now being made at reintegration, which is the effort to get fighters to choose to change sides, and reconciliation, which is a political matter. We have only talked about briefly. Ahmed Rashid is Pakistani journalist. He's based in Lahore, expert on the Taliban and relations between Afghanistan and his country, Pakistan. His latest book is Descent into Chaos, the United States and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. And Ahmed Rashid, it's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
What about this idea of reconciliation, which is being pushed very hard by President Karzai, the effort to try to reconcile, the term means what it says, with Taliban leaders?
Well, I the London conference, I think, for the first time actually brought together the international community behind this idea that you can fight and talk at the same time. There has to be a military offensive, as General Parker has said. You have to roll back the Taliban and show that they cannot gain more ground. But at the same time, you have to also acknowledge that they are in a position of strength and that perhaps this is the best time that you may be able, the Afghan government and others may be able to start talking to them. So I think that is what is really behind the effort. But in line with what Sarah says, you don't want President Karzai to use this excuse of talking to the Taliban as being the be-all and end-all of the policy. The policy has to be that he has to improve governance, and the Afghans have to improve governance at the same time. So you've got a very complicated scenario. You've got an offensive going on. You've got, at the same time, secret talks or semi-secret talks going on with various players involved, Saudi Arabia, possibly Pakistan, the Americans, possibly the UN, all sorts of other people. You've got talks at the tactical level whereby you're trying to bring in Taliban commanders off the field and some of their fighters. You've got talks at the strategic level, hopefully, between the Afghan government and the Taliban leadership, which is largely based in Pakistan. So it's a very, very complex next few months that we're going to see, and not all of it will be apparent. Obviously, there'll be a lot of focus on the military side, but at the same time, there will have to be a marked difference in the way that Western aid is being used and the way that the Afghan government improves its governance.
When you say that a time of strength for the Taliban might be the best time to talk, what do you mean?
Well, I think, you know, one reason given by the military is that you have to roll back the Taliban before you can talk to them. So you roll back the Taliban, and then maybe in 6 months you start talking to them. Another way of looking at this is to say that, well, the Taliban have actually reached the height of their influence. They are now a countrywide movement. They're all over the country. They have a shadow government in many provinces. But at the same time, they cannot take the cities. They cannot take the large population centers because of the firepower of ISAF and the Afghan army. They cannot mount a populist movement against foreign forces because they are just not that popular, and they can't provide any of the kind of services that Western aid can provide the Afghan population. So actually they've reached a kind of limit as to how far they can go. They can carry out certainly, you know, more brutal assassinations and massacres and these kinds of urban terrorism that we've seen in the last few weeks. But they can do more of that, but they can't actually improve their military or political situation from where it is now. And that is what I think is driving some Taliban leaders, at least, to think about talking to the Afghan government.
Ahmed Rashid, once again, a Pakistani journalist based in Lahore. Avanda Felbab Brown is a foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution, adjunct professor of the security studies program at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. And it's good to have you on our program as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's approach this from a political standpoint. How's it going to look in the United States if, in fact, there is negotiation going on with the Taliban leadership? What sorts of things do you think the Obama administration has to worry about in that context, especially in an election year?
The answer depends partially on the content of the negotiations. And I do believe that strategic negotiations with the Taliban are very problematic and counterproductive from a strategic point of view. But even if you just look at the political point of view, there is a real danger for the administration to signal that they do not believe the military offensive, the surge, the multifaceted surge, will make a difference. And they are, by engaging in strategic negotiation with the Taliban leadership that was responsible for the Al-Qaeda safe haven that will be associated with 9/11, really leaves the administration vulnerable to charges of being soft on protecting the U.S. homeland, protecting the U.S. people.
Why do you say that negotiations is problematic from a strategic standpoint?
Well, I take a different view here than Ahmed. There is an old adage that one should negotiate from the position of strength. And as all adages, it has some validity and it can be a cliché. But I do believe that it actually applies here. The more the Taliban believes that they are on the march, that they have the momentum on their side, the less they will be willing to negotiate, and the more their demand will be demands that, from my point of view, should be unacceptable, such as controlling strategic territory or having some sort of power-sharing arrangement with the government. And I'm also afraid that it might very well undermine the surge, that by signaling we're ready to negotiate at the very moment that we're starting to surge, we're signaling that the commitment is limited, that we don't have the wherewithal, that we don't expect to make a big change on the battlefield. So the policy, in my view, should be reversed. At the moment when we have clearly broken the Taliban momentum, when the military situation on the battlefield is on our side, that perhaps might be a moment when some sort of strategic talk with the leadership might be appropriate, but not before that. If you look at the conflict in Afghanistan, which Ahmed knows very well and has written a lot about, you see many commanders, many individuals frequently switching sides. And frequently the critical determinant why they switch sides is their expectation that the other party will win, that the other party will prevail in their area. It's a survival mechanism more than sort of profit-maximizing mechanism, if you'd like. So paradoxically, if we're engaging in strategic negotiations with the Taliban, we might very well be signaling to the middle commanders, to the individuals, that we will not prevail. And it might actually make the foot soldiers, the middle-level commanders, less motivated to reach some sort of negotiation, to come out, accommodation, to come out from the cold and demobilize.
Vonda Felbaugh-Brown, again at Brookings, back to Ahmed Rashid, our Pakistani journalist. What do you say to that? And is it inevitable that the Pakistan, that the Taliban will want to control territory, will want power sharing? Is there any way to get out of this politically without that?
Well, two things I'll say. I think the first thing is that, you know, we're dealing with a military surge which has a kind of deadline to it. That is, in 18 months' time, the Americans want to start handing over security to the Afghans and start pulling troops out. And certainly the pressure for Obama, President Obama, to do that in 18 months' time, given the state of the American economy and all the other issues and the elections coming up, etc., I think the pressure in 18 months to start pulling troops out of Afghanistan will grow and grow and grow. Now, the Taliban are not stupid. They know that as well. And there's every reason for them right now, if they were absolutely confident of themselves, to say, well, we sit out the Americans for 18 months and we wait for this handover. We know the Afghan army is never going to be really capable of running the country, and then we can take over or take more territory. And I think that the other problem that the ISAF faces is that many of the neighboring countries have also come to this conclusion, that the Americans are on the way out, and all everyone has to do is to sit quiet, and then they can start running in their proxies in Afghanistan, much as the neighboring countries, Iran, Pakistan, the Central Asians did during the civil war in the 90s. So I think, you know, that's the first problem that waiting for negotiations or waiting for talks, you know, would face. I think the second thing is to understand that the Taliban themselves are going through, I think, quite a metamorphosis, because they are having, many of them are very tired. Many of them are very fed up with Al-Qaeda and the de facto alliance that exists between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Many of them are very tired with the kind of manipulation and political pressures that they face in Pakistan. So, you know, all is not well in the Taliban camp. I mean, it can't be said that the Taliban are monolithic and growing and expanding with a united common agenda and front. I think what the idea of talks would be to try and sow dissension, further dissension within their ranks, make some of the more thinking Taliban come round to the idea of having talks, and, you know, increasing pressure on the central leadership. So I think I do believe that a policy of talk and fight is probably is what we are going to see over the next six months.
Back to Lieutenant General Sir Nick Parker, who is Deputy Commander of the International Security Assistance Force, the ISAF. What do you say to what Ahmed Rashid said about the Taliban simply waiting out the 18 months and the neighboring countries doing the same?
Well, as Ahmed knows, I don't entirely agree with him. I think, as I said earlier, it is a risk, and it is certainly a perception that is held by some today. But I think in 18 months' time, this is going to look very, very different. I think a great deal is going to happen over the next 18 months, which is going to strengthen the position of the Afghan government. It's going to build capacity in the Afghan security forces, that there will be a great deal of progress in local governance. Of course, there are going to be challenges, and it's not going to be a smooth run. But in 18 months' time, what appears now to be rather a sort of stark moment where the people are talking about almost as if we're going to leave, it isn't going to look like that at all. What it's going to look like is a country which is really beginning to get its act together and is very difficult for an insurgency to take a hold in.
Vonda Felbaugh-Brown at Brookings. What about Ahmed Rashid's point that the Taliban are metamorphizing, that they're tired, that they're fed up not only with al-Qaeda but with the Pakistanis as well?
Well, Ahmed is right that the Taliban is not monolithic. There are possibly factions and individuals that are fed up, that are tired. I am not as certain at all as Ahmed is that this is a pervasive trend. I still believe that the Quetta Shura, that the key Taliban leadership, the Haqqani network, are in fact rather close with al-Qaeda. There is a great deal of conversation between the two entities, if not direct cooperation. And, of course, the fact that they both are located in Pakistan only facilitates that exchange to go on. But Ahmed is absolutely right. The group is not monolithic. Many tribes, many commanders, mid-level commanders, call themselves Taliban and side with the Taliban for highly local reasons, highly local grievances that go back to some of the governance issues, such as systematic discrimination against Gilzai Pashtun by Durrani Pashtuns, that go back to conflict over water and land. And certainly these individuals can be peeled off, and these groupings can be peeled off by focusing on the grievances and helping to resolve them. I don't believe that's facilitated, however, by the strategic negotiations with the Taliban. Interestingly, the Taliban, the Kadashura, has been systematic over the past year or so sending messages that when they come back to power, they will be very good neighbors. They will not try to stir up jihadi confrontation, jihadi attacks in neighboring countries. This is, of course, very much directed toward Pakistan, trying to pressure or trying to persuade the Pakistani military and the ISI not to side with the United States, not to go against them, but it's also directed against other neighbors such as Iran and even some of the Central Asian republics. I would, however, be deeply skeptical of that message and deeply skeptical that if the Taliban, the hardcore Taliban, the Kadashura types do control territories, that they would turn on their comrades and not allow them to use these territories as safe havens.
Sarah Chase, back to you. Now an advisor to ISAF, the NATO commands having settled in Afghanistan, but former foreign correspondent for NPR. If a deal could be made with the Taliban whereby they would renounce al-Qaeda on some sort of meaningful, in some sort of meaningful way, do you think that the American public in an election year would be happy to hear that, and particularly if it meant that the United States was getting out of Afghanistan?
I'm not a good person to ask about the American public since I've been living in Afghanistan for, you know, the last 8 years, but I'd like to jump back in about the Afghan public. I mean, I find Ahmed, who's a dear friend, I find his position completely illogical. If we listen to what he just said, it's that the Taliban are weak, they're unpopular with the Afghan public, they are tired, they are under pressure from Pakistan. So why should there be any strategic level negotiation with them? We need to, in those circumstances, understand, well, why is it that they have been making headway? And what I've been hearing from Afghan people is that basically, you know, I'm going to go back to the point I made earlier, that the government is so painful to them in the way, in the exactions, in the abusive extraction of resources from this country, that they really don't feel any difference. And what I would hear from people is, you know, the Taliban harass us at night and the government harasses us in the daytime. Or the Taliban hit us on this cheek and the government hits us on this cheek, on the other cheek. And so for me, you know, you're in a situation, it's almost like there's a bunch of bullies who are beating up an innocent person on a street, and then there's somebody else who's shooting up the street because he wants a chance to beat up that person. And so then the question is, well, how do we solve this problem? Do we allow the guy who's shooting up the street to join the other bullies, or do we stop, you know, the attack? And so I don't understand the logic of strategic level negotiations, especially given the concerns that that you have suggested in two questions about what is the impact going to be, not just politically in America, but strategically worldwide. I mean, Muslims throughout the world are kind of watching this argument between radical Islam and, you know, a whole lot of other actors, meaning 42 other nations, Muslim and non-Muslim, who are here to help Afghanistan. And how those 42 other nations and the Afghan people do in this argument is really going to make up a lot of people's minds. And believe me, if there's a strategic level negotiation, which will certainly involve power and territory in return for peace, if that goes down, that is going to be hailed as a massive victory for radical Islam, whether or not there's some kind of a piece of paper that the Taliban might sign saying, you know, we won't let al-Qaeda in. And those strategic implications really need to be thought out before the rest of the world climbs on this negotiations bandwagon.
Let me let Ahmed Rashid respond to what you're saying. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I think the driving force is the reality on the ground around the world, which is that there's a collapse of will to carry on supporting the war in Afghanistan. There's a collapse of public will in Europe. In the major European countries, it's now 60-70% of the public do not want their governments to carry on the war in Afghanistan. And in America now, for the first time, it's really growing also. I think it's around 40-50% in America. People now, I think, you know, this is what is really driving Western policy at the moment. This is the longest war that the West has fought, longer than the Second World War. People are tired of seeing body bags of their countrymen coming back. And much as I would very much like to defeat the Taliban, because I'm also fearing very much the Pakistani Taliban right now, and we don't know what the impact of the Afghan Taliban success or negotiations would be on the Pakistani Taliban. But the fact of the matter is that I think we have to deal with the reality on the ground in the West, and that the West has signaled very, very strongly that this is not an unlimited commitment of troops and money and materials. And dealing with that means that we have to try and help end the war as quickly as possible. So no longer is this about defeating the Taliban militarily. It's no longer about trying to bring democracy to Afghanistan, unfortunately, because these are positions that I've supported in the last 8 or 9 years since 9/11. It's no longer even about nation building in that sense. It's about ending the war as soon as possible. This is what the Americans and the Europeans want. Unfortunately, it's not a great help to the Afghan people, but there is a time limit to all this now, and that's been stated very clearly in the London conference. The second thing is, I think, you know, 6 months ago, you didn't have many of these countries supporting the idea of talks. You have all of them now at the London conference. There was no dissension from the general communique, which talked about, having tactical talks, you know, with the Taliban commanders, etc.
General Parker, I have to let you respond to that, if you will. Ahmed Rashid says that the principal drive behind Western policies is to get out of Afghanistan.
I think he's just trying to provoke me, actually. I think the line that I would take is that what is happening at the moment demonstrates an extraordinary commitment from those people who are investing in ISAF, particularly the United States. The United States' contribution to what we're doing at the moment is very, very significant. I think the people of America should be extremely proud of what their forces are doing, and that they should be reassured that there is going to be a change over the next few months, and we will exploit that change, and it's going to make a difference.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us today. Lieutenant General Sir Nick Parker, again, Deputy Commander of ISAF in Afghanistan, number two to General Stanley McChrystal. Ahmed Rashid, Pakistani journalist based in Lahore, his latest book, Descent into Chaos. Sarah Chase, formerly with NPR, now an advisor to ISAF, the NATO command in Kabul. And Vanda Phalab Brown, foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution, adjunct professor at Georgetown University. Good to have all of you with us to talk about the situation in Afghanistan.